Forests, marshes, savanna grasslands, and creeks, estuaries, lagoons, sandbars, and tidal islands were important physical features of the Lower Gambia River Basin's landscape. In the 18th century, visitors to the area would have seen forests, estuaries, a river, marshes, and the broad savanna lands within a few kilometers of the banks of the Gambia River. The region had unique ecological, social, economic, and political characteristics that for centuries shaped the lives of the people who lived there. Welcome to the African Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Madina Thiam. In today's episode, we are going to discuss land, we are going to discuss Mandinka political elites, forest-dwelling spirits, jihad, and peanut production with our guest, Dr. Hassan Sarr. Dr. Sarr is an associate professor of history at Ohio University, and you just heard an expert from his book, Islam, Power, and Dependency in the Gambia River Basin, The Politics of Land Control, 1790 to 1940, which was published with the University of Rochester Press in 2016. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sarr. Thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Madina, for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you about my work.
So, can you begin by introducing yourself and telling us more about your background, about your training, and how you came to develop this specific project?
Sure. Like you mentioned, I am an associate professor of history at Ohio University. I came to this university in fall of 2013. Prior to that, I taught at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. After receiving my PhD at Michigan State University under the supervision of Walter Houghton and David Robinson. I came into this project in the spring of 2006 while taking a graduate seminar on the Atlantic slave trade. In that class, I was introduced to great works of African historians that seem to underappreciate the important ways land arrangements shape or were shaped by political and spiritual systems of pre-colonial Africans, in this case, people in the Lower Gambia River. In trying to explain why slavery was prevalent in late 18th and 19th century Africa, some scholars seem to suggest that pre-colonial Africa was characterized by low population densities relative to the amount of land available, that land was in abundance and thus it had limited value. Some of these scholars also argued that the only option for any ambitious person who wanted to accumulate wealth was to own people, since labor was in short supply, not land. Others proposed a more nuanced answer to the question by suggesting that population densities were not necessarily low in all of Africa, but African societies did not recognize individual ownership of land, so that African law only allowed communal ownership, which by implication was very restrictive. As a graduate student, I reflected on the conclusions of many of those studies. And as I did so, I could not help but think about the 20th century conditions in my tiny farming village on the Gambia's North Bank, where my late father and my male siblings worked on the peanut and millet fields to eke out a living. In this village, like in others around it, land relationships were deeply hierarchical and spiritual. And because of that, I wondered, might there be some history behind this arrangement, that is, this land arrangement in my village or in my part of the Gambia, that I can investigate to challenge this dominant worldview? In brief, this is how I began to work on this project.
And so your book begins in that period of the late 18th century. So could you paint for us the political picture of the Lower Gambia River in that time period, from the late 18th to the mid-19th century? And in particular, could you explain to us why did land control become a central feature of Mandinka political power building and the political culture in the region at the time?
For over four centuries, people living along the banks of the Gambia River lived in separate political units. Some have called them kingdoms, others refer to them as states. These were Nyomi, Jokadu, Badibu, Jara, Kiang, and Kombo. If you notice, Fonyi is another region or district that I did not mention here, but it was mainly dominated by Jola-speaking peoples who were more or less a decentralized society, whose people did not share the same political logic or system that the Mandinka or the Wolof had. All these political units had ties with Kabu, with the exception of Fonyi, again. The more powerful political state to the south of the Gambia River, that's Kabu. The ruling class in Nyomi, Jokadu, Badibo, etc., they developed a very close relationship with the Kabunkas. From the mid-19th century, Lower Gambians referred to this political class as the Soninke, who were notorious for rejecting Islam, consuming alcohol, and unleashing a violent and an oppressive system on their subjects. Gambian elders I interview refer to this era as the period when the Kidifai Mansolu were in power. That is the period between the late 18th century to the mid-19th century. The Kidifai Mansolu were the kings whose authority was drawn lightly from the guns that they possessed. So one of the characteristic features of this political class was that no one dared to challenge their authority. As the power holders, they also viewed themselves as the bankutiolus, meaning the owners of the land. Control of land during this period was a means through which political exclusion of the peasant population was ensured, as the 1821 Mandinari case that I write about in the book shows. In 1821, two Methodist missionaries named John Baker and John Morgan arrived in the Gambia, and they wanted to establish a mission station there. So they visited the state of Kombo and had an audience with the Mansa of Kombo, who was then based in one of the royal towns called Yundum, the royal towns of Kombo. The Mansa was then based there, and they explained themselves that they needed land and so on and so forth. And the Mansa told them, okay, you go with my servant here and look around my state. Anywhere that you see a land that you really wanted, come back and let me know. So they went to a town called Mandinari on the mouth of the Gambia River, and saw a site that they were interested in, and they went back and told the king, who then gave them the permission to go and settle on that land. But in the process of starting the construction, the Mandinari elders drove them away. And even though the missionaries explained that it was the king who gave them permission to settle there, the community still refused. So when the king got the news that the elders of Mandinari has chased away the missionaries, he himself went there and had an audience with the elders. And the elders still rejected his instructions, so he threatened them. But the argument that the elders put forward was instructive, because they said that the land was theirs, and by virtue of their birthright rights, nobody can alienate the land without without their permission. The king countered that argument, saying that as the owner of the land, as the king, he had the power to do whatever he wanted. And if, and this was the threat that he gave to the elders of Mandinare, if anyone challenged his authority, he said he would tie ropes around their necks, basically to strangulate them. And as soon as he delivered his threat, the elders surrendered and allowed the missionary to establish their mission. So for me, I gave a number of different cases in which the political class exercised power over the administration of land, and they benefited from such power because of the kinds of political power that they wielded. So I talk about those kinds of cases in the first part of the book.
So land management was a central feature or a key feature of political power, but as you argue in the book also, humans' interactions with spirits and with the realm of non-human being, with the non-human world, also heavily influenced land use and influenced the ecology in the Lower Gambia River Basin. How so?
Yes, Lower Gambians believe that land was divided into two spaces. One, land for human habitation and use, and two, lands dwelt by spirits. Unless if one was a hunter, blacksmith, or a Muslim cleric, people generally avoided trespassing on these lands. In people's understanding, these lands were not vacant, as many historians suggest. The fact that people did not settle on certain lands or cultivate certain lands doesn't mean that there was free land available everywhere. In the Gambia region, the view that spirits could occupy this land, spirits such as condorongs, which I write about, these were the dwarf creatures that look like human beings, but they're very, very, very soft and often with maybe irregular heads. Then you have the jinns, and then the ninkinankas, the ninkinanka being the dragon, the word for dragon. They live in these spaces, and people believe that they could ruin the lives of anyone who trespass on these spaces. So the fact that there are these malicious spirits that occupy certain portions of the forest or of the swamps means that for the people who live in those areas, not all land was therefore readily available. Because of this belief also in spirits and spirit lands, many parts of the country was therefore preserved or untouched by human settlements or farmlands by as late as the second half of the 19th century. This is why I argued in the book that this belief in spirits serves as an ecological function. Yes, the people might not have had the consciousness might not have, let me put it this way, they might not have been preserving the land as a conscious decision of conservation, but it was an unintended outcome of this belief system that prevailed in the area.
And so from the second half of the 19th century onwards, you show that massive shifts occur in the region in general, but also particularly in the Lower Gambia, in the sociopolitical, economic, religious realms. So can you lay out for us a little bit of that history and especially explain these Soninke Marabout wars of the 1840s to the 1900s?
Sure. The second half of the 19th century was in many ways transformative. Lots of things happened during this period, among them the rise of the agricultural population against the Soninke ruling class who long dominated the politics of the area. In the Gambia, this uprising is known as the Soninke Marabout Wars. It began when the famous jihadist Maba Jahuba waged a jihad against the Mansa of Badibou, reap on the Gambia's north bank to the east of Niamey. Then orders came in later. People like Fode Silla, Fode Kaba, they all wage jihads against the ruling class. Historians have discussed the 19th century jihads in the context of their religious inspirations and or aspirations, as well as the outbreaks of these jihads in the aftermath of the slave trade. What seemed to be forgotten is that people in this region were farmers and not slave traders in the first place. They were farmers before slave traders or anything else. They were people who wanted to end the oppressiveness of the political system, end their exclusion from the political institution, and reorganize land relations. So my focus on the Soninke-Marabu War was to help demonstrate how the Mandinka political aristocracy was brought down, was brought to its knees. That was one first important change that occurred from the mid-19th century onwards. But these transformations can't be understood in isolation from the other developments that were also equally important. So I talk about that in the second half of the book.
Yeah, and as you explain, another important consequence is that quote-unquote battle or struggle takes place from the mid-19th century onwards between the marabout, the Muslim clerics, on the one hand, and then the local spirits that you discussed earlier on the other hand. And this battle takes place over the issue of being able to clear land, and land will then be used for peanut production. So can you tell us a little bit about these processes, like how these shifts occur in that time period?
Absolutely. What you are referring to happened in the second half of the 19th century as well. This period saw the influx of people that either identified or were regarded as Muslim clerics, people who claimed to have special powers that enabled them to conquer or convert spirits into Islam. Many of the jinns or the kondorons or the ninkinankas were non-Muslims. At least that's how they were described. I argue that it was these Muslim clerics who were responsible for the opening of new lands for peanut cultivation during the expansion of commercial agriculture. In return, these Muslim specialists used this to attract more dependents to their homes and their villages. That's the first point. The second point is that stories of Muslim specialists battling with spirits highlight another crucial historical reality. That is, in the Gambia region, warfare was not simply a military reality. That is a kind of physical confrontation. Wars can also be fought in the spiritual domain. For example, fighting over land could involve people consulting shrines, priests, or Muslim clerics, and to cast spells with the help of these people, to cast spells on people competing with spells that could cause blindness, paralysis, or mental illness. It can also result in even death, all happening because of conflict over land. So that's number two. Number three, what this topic also entails is that it means that the Muslim clerics who wage the spiritual jihads against evil spirits have an important symbol or an important language to deploy for the public in order to attract people towards them. Some of these spirits could become Muslims, and those that refuse to accept Islam would be chased out. So these kinds of stories were more or less parts of the karamas or the miracles that some of these Muslim clerics would claim, or their followers would claim, that they had performed. Miracles serve an important function. They were for the audience, for people to be convinced that, well, such and such Marabu or Muslim clerics is a powerful individual. So why not get close to this person for your own solutions, for your own to find solutions to your own problems? So driving away spirits from the land or rendering them harmless resulted in two things, I argue. One, the massive clearing of lands for farming and for human settlement. Many villages along the banks of the Gambia River appeared from the mid-19th century going into the 20th century. In other words, many new villages and forests were cleared and established during this period. The second outcome that I also discuss is that the ability for Marabouts to attract more followers, like I said earlier, depended on the power of these kinds of stories. From then on, Marabouts will replace the political class as the landowners. Now they will be the ones who will now be distributing land or whose permission strangers or newcomers would actually seek before they can settle on a particular place.
Dr. Sa, I was actually about to ask you this question a little bit later, but what you're saying is so rich, and the connections you're making between the spiritual realm, the material use of land, the different ways that warfare can be waged. I'm really curious now to ask you now about your research process for the book and how you build this argument. I mean, I suspect you did not arrive to it immediately. So I'm very curious how you did the research for this and how you slowly arrived at these conclusions and these connections that you're making here.
That's a very good question. The research process, well, I started working on this project since I was a doctoral student. Now, what you see in the book is definitely quite different from the way I constructed my doctoral dissertation. So I guess I was lost in my as a doctoral student. But when I started teaching, I had more time and more resources to really do the research and think about this more carefully. And so I spent a lot of time traveling to several villages in the Gambia, interviewing people. Some of the interviews, great, some good, some not so helpful. The time I spent in the archives were also very challenging. But I basically had an approach that I was just testing out. I nobody told me you have to do this. I just tried it out. First, I had a number of different anecdotes. For example, the 1821 Mandinari case that I talked about earlier. So I had a case like that. So I read it in a missionary account. And so I wanted to ask the people of Yundum and the people of Mandinari, for example, what they know about the story. That exercise did not really yield any fruitful answers for me in the oral sources. However, I talked about other cases that occurred sometime in the middle of the in the second half of the 19th century. So, for example, the land conflicts that engulfed the communities of Bambali, Tandaito, and Kumbija on the Gambia's north bank. These stories I saw in the first traveling commissioner's report on the north bank, dated 1893 to 1894, wherein when the British colonial government declared a protectorate over the Gambia, the Gambian hinterland, the first traveling commissioner to the North Bank was on a tour to the region, and he visited Bambali, Tandaito, and Kumbija. And in some of these places, and Sarakunda, I should say, the people brought a complaint to him that about 50 years ago, during the wars that Sid Mati or Biran Cisse fought, Sid Mati being the son of Maba Jahoba and Biran Cisse, one of the generals of Maba Jahoba, the people said, you know, our community either align with this person or that person. And when the war was finished and we lost or that person won, our land was taken away and given to this community. We want this land back. So with that anecdote, I was able to go to Sarakunda, Bambali, Tandaito, and Kumbija to interview people. To my surprise, with little information from the archive, you can actually prepare yourself for better questions, for more useful questions when you go into this community. So if you look at each chapter, I try to start it with something that I found in the documentary sources, and then used it to also frame my questions for the people that I interview. So that was something that I tried out. It worked in most cases, but not in all cases. Another thing that I want to share also with the research process, as a junior scholar, I had to reach out to a lot of senior colleagues who gently, you know, about my research, but they gently warned me one after another that there is nothing in the archives that would provide evidence for what I wanted to do. So, you know, now as a faculty member, I am a bit more careful about what to say to graduate students, never to speak in those strong terms that nothing can be found. I'm happy that I was adamant that I wanted to do this project, because if I had listened to some senior colleagues, I would have abandoned this project early on.
Oh, that's very useful to hear, especially at this stage for me. And there's something else that I wanted to ask you about. And the readers who are not familiar with the book or who haven't picked it up can look it up online and see for themselves. I was very curious about the photo on the book's cover. I was wondering if you could tell us more about it.
Sure. I like this image. It is the photo of Kaba Cham, who was appointed chief of Western Kombo. Kaba is a very fascinating historical character. And his story reflects the kind of change that also happened from the late 19th century to the early 20th century with the imposition of European colonial rule, i.e. the British taking over the Gambia. Kaba did not come from the traditional Soninke ruling class. So he was not a Jata or a Bojang who historically had ruled the Kingdom of Kombo for many centuries prior to their removal from power, forced by the jihadists for the Silla, and later by the British who took over this place. So why was Kaba appointed as a chief? What gave him the political legitimacy to be a chief? That I think it's a very, very important thing. But back to the image. The image illustrates a kind of dependency, relationship of dependency that I think the book discusses. First, it shows Kaba being summoned to answer to the district officer, who is a white British guy, his superior. And so Kaba is seated face to face with this white man, who is seated in a more elegant chair with his guards. But Kaba's people are also sitting behind him on the ground, which also shows another level of dependency. Then you have the background. in which you see the landscape, the trees, etc. So I got this photo from the National Archives in London. I love it. It's great.
No, it is really a perfect cover for this book because it captures so many of the themes that you then discuss in more details in the book and these processes. And especially the image of the forest and the trees in the background. It's really striking. So I wanted to ask you, I guess, moving a little bit away from specifically this region of the Lower Gambia, what did you wish with this project for African readers at large or readers interested in historical and contemporary Africa in general to take away from this book and from this research?
Very good question. Well, I was asked a question once when I was presenting an aspect of this research to an audience, a group of people. And somebody asked me, Gambia is a very small place. And so this case, how does this case really alter the argument or the conclusions that other scholars have said about other regions in Africa, which are bigger and more representative of the African continent? And I said, well, again, we have to go back to what I had hoped to do as a historian, that is to at least try to dialogue with the existing body of scholarship to show that some of these long-held assumptions that for a very long time have been peddled by historians maybe are quite problematic. Maybe it's time for people to begin to revisit some of these ideas. Now, for a very long time, I think when it comes to the idea of spirituality and land and spirits, historians have abdicated, have abandoned this topic to the anthropologists, and so they haven't really investigated it. And that's not the case for all of Africa, but certainly for West Africa, I felt that there wasn't much attention being paid by historians on this phenomenon. So I wanted to first challenge this scholarship, this body of scholarship, and hopefully use it as a start for another level of conversation that other historians, future historians, can have about various other regions. So that's the first. The other, building on that, I hope that this book highlights land's value for production and sustaining power relationship. That slavery was one level of dependency. It wasn't the only form of dependency. For the Muslim elites of the mid-19th century, there was a more effective way to create dependency aside from slavery. Slavery perhaps was required a lot more resources to maintain such an institution. But to have a group of followers and talibes, Muslim students around a marabout, that was another level of dependency that was not as threatening. And so I wanted to talk about those kinds of situations. The other thing that I also did not really want to get into, if you look at the study of pre-colonial Africa, particularly for West Africa, much of the scholarship is centered on the Atlantic trade. And nothing wrong with that. But I wanted to focus on farmers, on peasants, on people who were tied to the land, who were not necessarily commercial agents or were not people who were actively involved in the commercial ventures that ended up in that connected with the Atlantic slave trade. So that's the other thing. Obviously, the challenge was that I could not go as far back into the 18th century beyond the last decade of the 18th century. So I could not really talk about that because of the limited nature of sources. But I gave a lot of examples of ways in which control of land by a group of people shaped relationships of social dependency over time. And at the heart of this book's argument is that, again, colonial rule was not the only influence on change or the changes in African institutions. In the Lower Gambia, forms of land control have been changing since the attack on the ruling class, which began in the mid-19th century. And Islam was a significant force in this overall process. So these are some major themes that I want people to take in. And finally, if I may, I also think that it's important that we try to also write African history with a great deal of attention to African worldviews, African ideas. And we can't do that very well without also respecting oral histories. That I really cannot overemphasize that point. The archives are just as problematic as the oral histories. So the challenge is for us to learn how to also glean from the oral sources meaningful ideas that we can use to communicate the African views as well, which are just as important as the oral, as the written record, which were produced mostly by Europeans. So that's also another important takeaway point that I think I would like readers to know.
Mm. No, it's so important, and the book really does that for me. At least, it was really a model on how to really center these views and take them seriously, these African views, as opposed to just exploiting them in trying to write these histories. So yes, no, it really does that. And it was really useful as a graduate student also reading this as a model on how to do this later on. So Dr. Sa, I guess just one last question. I was wondering, since the publication of the book came out in 2016, what else have you been working on? What big projects or small projects are in the works right now for you?
I was tired when I finished this project. So and I'm lazy, but anyway, since finishing the book in 2016, I've been working on two projects simultaneously, but one has now taken the backseat more than the other one. The first one was the project on the liberated Africans and their descendants who were taken to the Gambia in Batos and settled there in Georgetown. So I've been working on that project, but that project would take me more time than the other one. So I focus since about, I would say 2 years ago, I focused most of my attention on this book, on the history of the Tijaniya movement, the Tijaniya order in Senegambia. So as you know, there has been a lot of studies on various Marabouts who were Tijaniyas and who were Tijans. But one thing that I seem to see in this scholarship is that much of the Gambia region and south of the Gambia, that is southern Senegal, Casamance, and Guinea-Bissau, are basically absent in this literature. So I've been working on an itinerant Muslim clerical family who took the Tijani Tariha into parts of the Gambia region, into Casamance and Guinea-Bissau. One of the pioneers of this family was named Tierno Muhammadu Diallo, who came from the Fouta Djallon area in a village in Labe, that's called Sare Kali, who then left his homeland in Fouta Djallon for Fouta Toro, where he spent much of his education before moving to Saint Louis, where he supposedly received the Tijani Tariha, and then from Sheikh Umar Tal, and then he was asked by Alhaji Umar to move south to the Gambia and into Casamance, into Kolda and the Firdu country in general. So he had trained a lot of disciples who then disseminated the Tijani Tariha Fuada into the Firdu country for the most part. The Firdu are these Fulas who it's a dialect of the wider Halpular language. So I've been working on that project, and I was hoping to be back in Casamance and parts of Guinea-Bissau this summer, but like everyone else, we are stuck here.
Yeah, we are recording this during the COVID-19 pandemic, and obviously it has changed a lot of plans and a lot of settings for many people. But we're excited to see where this research will take you, and also impatient to see the results and be able to read about it. It surely sounds fascinating. Yes, and again, we've taken out a bit of your time today, so we'll wrap up. But thank you so much, Dr. Sah, for coming to talk to us today. So again, for our listeners, this was Dr. Hassan Sah, who was presenting his 2016 book, Islam, Power, and Dependency in the Gambia River Basin, The Politics of Land Control, 1790 to 1940, which was published with the University of Rochester Press as part of the Rochester Studies in African History and the Diaspora. Thanks again very much, Dr. Sah, for your time today. It was really a fascinating and enlightening conversation.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.